This episode of the Scale by Numbers podcast is brought to you by our new virtual advisory subscription called CFO Thinking Partner. It's a monthly membership that offers CFO level support and expert guidance that will fast track your business goals, financial skills, and fundraising efforts. You will have access to live support, resources, and tools to move you past any obstacle that is stalling your company's growth efforts. For more information, go to products.vanrusselventures.com/CFO Thinking Partner. Again, that's products.vanrusselventures.com/CFO Thinking Partner.
Well, thanks everybody for joining me for my Scale by Numbers podcast. I'm thrilled to be launching season two. Season one was all about creating a strong business foundation upon which you can grow and scale. We talked to corporate attorneys, auditors, HR professionals, accountants, insurance advisors, growth experts, and with some software companies like Rippling, Carta, FounderSuite, and Lately AI, to name just a few. If you worked with all these firms, you'd be perfectly set up for your next step, which is the topic of season two. Over the next dozen weeks, we'll be talking to some of the industry's best VC firms, fundraising experts, and accelerator programs, both in the US and a smidgen internationally as well. We'll be talking to for-profit investors as well as some foundations, and we'll throw in one or two surprise guests that are going to be talking about some things that you may not associate with business success, but that are quintessential to making it long-term. So with no further ado, here we go. Well, welcome everybody to another episode and a new season of Scale by Numbers. And the person that I really wanted on first is Brett Chernow of Broad Scope Consulting. And the reason that I wanted him on is because he is the fundraising specialist and we can learn a ton from him. So Brett, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, James. Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's really wonderful to be here. I focus on raising capital, as you said, for both startup and high growth companies. I've been doing it for, three decades now, most of which has come from the Bay Area. And over that time, I've raised just north of $800 million for my clients. Focus on hardware, software, medical. I've done projects for schools. I've done consumer product goods. Pretty much seen and touched most everything out there. And I really love working with entrepreneurs and people who are really trying to scale and get their business to a place that's really going to attract the attention of the marketplace and investors.
That's great. What would you, first of all, when do people reach out to you?
Unfortunately, many of them reach out actually too late. The ideal time to reach out for help raising money is about 12 months before you need the capital. And that gives us enough time to go through the entire raise process, which involves everything from coming up with the three C's, as I call it, your compelling case for customers. Why does somebody want to rip the product or service out of your hand and pay you for it? You have to have that in order to be successful at raising capital. And candidly, you have to have that to be successful in the business arena, competing against everybody who's out there with a substitute or a competitive product or service. Frequently, people reach out too late. They're down to a 3 month. I've heard that before. There's a rule in the industry that has become myth, but it transferred actually from myth to reality. It takes 90 days to raise capital. That's what's believed. And I chuckle when I hear that because it might take 90 days after you've got a term sheet and when the investor is doing their diligence from that point until the check's in the bank. But there are many steps that have to happen before that. The strategy has to be developed, as I was saying, those three C's. You have to develop a financial planning model that forecasts the business into the future. You have to develop a pitch deck, and those components, strategy, pitch deck, and financial model need to be inextricably linked. You can't change one without the other. So they have to tell a story And I'm not talking about a fairy tale kind of story. I'm talking about a story that will excite investors. And that process, and then the practice of the pitch, which I work with entrepreneurs on all the time, how do they stand up in front of an investor and come across as solid, credible, knowledgeable, have the ability to change the business and the business focus as they discover things in the future, because that's always happens and the investors know that. So how do we put all that together so that when they stand up in front of the investors, they've got a really great pitch. They're a shining example of a wonderful CEO who's the jockey on the horse who can really ride it well and take it forward. And it takes more than 90 days, way more. There's a video on my website and an article that talks about time to raise capital on broadscope.com. And the estimate from scratch, if you haven't done anything, is 9 to 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Before I move on with my next question, I did want to ask you, what type of customer do you typically get? So what, not everybody's raising VC money, but if you think about this, the different series, where's your kind of 80-20 split? Where do you live?
So I would say that the majority of my raises are venture capital raises. And when I say that, what does that mean? Because that target sometimes moves around based on where we are in the economy. But typically in the $2 to $3 million range at the bottom, up to, let's just say, $20 million for a Series A is pretty typical. I do later rounds, B, C, et cetera. And those rounds I'm typically doing after I've helped a client raise an A. Every once in a while, I'm brought in for a later round when they're either struggling on their own. In other words, they were successful raising an A, but they're having trouble raising a B. Or the group that they hired to help them is struggling and they're not getting traction on a later round. I do some work in the angel arena, high net worth individuals, family offices, those kind of things. You know, $500,000, $1 million is not uncommon. And I do some work in the private equity arena too. PE companies that really want to come in and put some money down. And that company obviously has to be significantly further along in their revenue stream. PE companies are typically looking for companies that are showing revenues and where they can come in as the PE firm, affect the management in some way, advisory or changing the team, significantly increasing revenues and profitability, and then flipping the company in a period of time.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about strategy and the gaps that are there, because I'll talk a little bit about what I see in a minute, which is more around the data room and the back office and accounting and financials and stuff. But I think around the strategy, you know, where do you see the biggest gaps when it comes to that?
It's a great question. And it's got a lot of tentacles to it. So let me break it down into a couple, not addressing the ones you just talked about. But when I'm working with a client on a capital raise or on a business strategy as a standalone, because I do that a lot as well. The client necessarily doesn't want to raise money. But they're not growing at the rate they want to grow at. So that kind of strategy is the type of strategy where you're looking at what's the business, what's that 3 C's case again, what's the compelling case for customers? Have they figured that out? Many founders and startup CEOs started off in the engineering realm. They're technical. They could be electrical, they could be mechanical, they could be anything where there's a technical focus, and they're brilliant at that. To take that brilliance and that idea, product or service, and translate it into a compelling strategy takes a significant amount of effort. You can't focus on the technical details of the product or service. You have to focus on what is exciting to your end target market. How are you going to package the product or service for that market? And then what does your go-to-market strategy look like? In other words, how are you going to get it into the field? How are you going to garner brand image? And how are you actually going to sell the product or service and make people crave what you have created. That type of strategy work may have nothing to do with capital raise. That's just, how do I build a successful business? How do I grow the business and grow revenues and scale, which of course means growing revenues at a faster rate than you're growing expenses and capital required for that business. That's one of the things that investors are really looking for. And as a founder or a CEO, that's something you should be looking for as well, because that's what will return money to the shareholders. That will help you continue to grow the business. So that type of strategy is the business strategy per se. And executing that's important, and that's its own bailiwick of knowledge and taking the business forward. There's another type of strategy, and that's capital raise strategy. And capital raise strategy certainly has many of the components that I just spoke about with regard to the business strategy. You need to know all the things I just went through, right? What's your compelling case for customers? What's your product or service? How are you selling it? What are your distribution channels look like? How are you scaling the business? Have you taken into account that you need a lot of money because this is a very capital intensive business, for example, and you need a lot of equipment to make the product? All that needs to come into play. But then there's also the key pieces around, well, how do I raise money? And that gets into number one, how much money do I need now and potentially in follow-on rounds? What's the potential ROI, return on investment of that money? And does it meet the investor screen? And what I mean by that is, if you're going to go try to raise venture capital money, venture capitalists have in mind some standards in terms of how much they put in and how much they get out at the end of the day. Will your business return the amount that the investors need so that they want to put money in? And will it return that amount in the time frame that they need? Those are two critical questions. And this is why, when you're looking at raising money, part of it is how much, part of it's what the return is, and part of it's when will the fund return? And that will help tell you whether you're going to look for angel money, venture money, private equity money, or there's no way that this firm will provide the return that any of those investors needs, and you have to look at some other option. That won't work. So figuring out those things is critical. And then once you figure out, let's just say you're in the venture arena, well, which one or two or 10? How do you know to find which investors are best for your business? Frequently, what I see happen, and this is much more common than I ever expected when I first started doing this work. Let's say you know Sally, and Sally's a partner at XYZ Ventures. And I come to you as an entrepreneur, I'm a friend of yours, and you look at my thing, whatever it is, and you get really excited about it. And you say, I've got a really good friend, Sally, who's part of XYZ Ventures. I'm going to introduce you. Well, that's great. But does XYZ Ventures invest in the type of business that I'm in? Do they invest in the stage of investment that I am looking for? In other words, there are some VCs that only invest in later rounds. They don't want to take the risk of an early round. So they don't invest in the A round. They invest in, let's say, C round. So if you connect me with Sally, Sally will probably talk to me because she's your friend and a colleague. But it's a waste of both of our times because Sally is never going to invest in my business. Maybe she knows somebody that might, so there's a potential lead there. But if I go in with the expectation that Sally's going to be interested because Sally's your friend, that's going down the wrong path and is going to take time. And when you're raising money, back to the question you asked earlier, when do companies approach me? You don't have time to waste. One of the critical things around raising money, every moment counts. So if you are spending any time using it in an inefficient way, as I would have been if I had spoken with Sally, that's taking time away from the right investors with whom I should be speaking. So figuring out types of investors and who is critical for my business.
OK, Yeah, no, that's great. And I love those, the criteria, the what return do they expect? Because I get that all the time. You know, because if it's not 100x, it's just not VC. You know, the time frame, 7 to 10 years, and then the amount of dollars as well. You know, really, you know, it's just three great criteria there. I think what I was mentioning earlier on the, you know, how do you get the back office in shape? I get brought in all the time to, you know, to raise money, but there's a problem. You know, we haven't closed the books in 6 to 9 months. We have way too much debt. How do we restructure it? We have, it'll take they need the money in 3 to 4 months, but it's going to take 6 months just to get the data room ready because it's just not available. So I always season one of Scale by Numbers was all about getting the right vendors right from the start. So that, you know, when you're ready to raise money, when you're ready to scale, you're just ready. Like you've got your A team there. You have nothing to worry about. Payroll is done. The accounting's closed. You know, all your numbers are coming in monthly to make the right decisions. And investors will see that because the amount of times that, you know, I'll talk to an investor who's interested in it and they'll say, okay, you know, send me your stuff. And it's like, we're not quite ready yet. And you actually make the investor wait, which never looks good.
So
I'd like your comments on that as well, because I see that all the time and it can be avoided so easily.
So this is one of those that the series raise that you're looking for, seed round, right? Small amount of money, angel, friends and family type investor versus venture capital investor at an A or even a later round, a B or a C, versus a private equity investor. And let's talk about the key categories you just went through, because at the early stages of a company, I chuckle, but I frequently see the company come to me with a shoebox full of receipts. And I mean, for real, it may not be a shoebox, but it's usually a folder. And it's like, well, here's our financials. They don't have an income statement or a balance sheet. They don't have anything along those lines. They're putting in their money, their own personal money typically, and they're funding the business based on whatever the expenses come in. And that's where you come in, where you have to take that folder or shoebox and say, oh, really, this is where you are? Well, we need to get you into some software that is going to take these receipts and put it in generally accepted accounting procedures format, GAAP, so that the investor will be satisfied what's here. Now, in the earlier rounds, that's not as important as it is in the later rounds. It's still important that you have a set of financials that they can look at and do their diligence on. But as you get into the later rounds, a lot of these things become more important. So let's talk about each one. Certainly, you've got financial statements, income statement, balance sheet, cash flow is important. One of the questions that comes up in the later rounds is, have you had an audit? Right? Has a private company come in and audited you to make sure that you're putting the expenses in the right category, that things foot and tick, that people aren't stealing money from the business, all the basics of an audit. And many startup companies don't think about that. Well, you probably don't need an audit in a seed round. But when you get to an A round, depending upon how much money you're raising and the firm from which you're raising, they may ask that question. And they're certainly going to ask it at B. So when was your last audit? Who did it? Was it one of the big firms? Was it a small firm? Are they credible? Those kinds of questions. Cap table. Capitalization table is one of those documents that, of course, should be in the back room and shows the investors who owns the company and what percentage do they own. And they're also going to want to see how much debt's on the books. That can be a real problem if you're going to raise equity, because debt holders get first money out if the company goes bankrupt. And frequently, there's not enough money to pay the equity holders anything. So if you have a big pile of debt on the books, it's going to cause significant issues with raising equity. And to your point of a few minutes ago, do they need to restructure that debt and make it equity or convertible debt that will convert to equity at some point in the time? So a big question. And then, of course, all the things around the pitch deck. Do they have a deck that they can send out? Does it have spelling errors? And of course, we haven't even talked about the financial model yet, which is that wonderful Excel workbook that takes the investor and candidly takes the senior team of the company through the business strategy that reflects what you want to do. I like to look at that Excel workbook as somebody has been able to translate the story and the words of the business into numbers. And when that model is built well and presented to the senior team, when they're looking at that model, let's say it's up on a screen, I frequently get the CEO looking at their team and pointing up at the board and saying, "I see it, that's our business." Because the model has been well designed and tells the story extremely well. You can see exactly who the customers are, what the revenues are, how many units you're selling, what are the costs of goods sold, how does the go-to-market strategy translate into numbers, and then how does the balance sheet roll out for final cash flow? So when you look at monthly cash flow and you see numbers, you understand exactly where they came from. And that tells us, how much money the company needs to raise and when. And then you have to get back to the point we were talking about a few minutes ago. Does it pencil out in terms of the investors? How much is needed in this round? How much is needed in a follow-on round? And do the numbers pencil out in terms of the step up in valuation between the rounds and the ultimate return on investment for the founders and for the investors? So yeah, all that has to be buttoned up in a data room. And if things are missing, it raises what I call either a yellow flag or a red flag for potential investors. And some of these things aren't a big deal, especially in the earlier stages. Okay, you might not have an audit, as I was saying earlier. But you need to have a cap table so that the investors understand who owns what and how many investors are in the mix and who they are. And is it this really messy cap table where there's lots of investors and lots of mess happening, where they have to clean that up, or that may be a problem for them down the road, or is it clean? And you know, it's red flag if you don't have one of those. So, and the fact that you don't know you need one of those is also a red flag, right? The investors are looking to the CEO to run the business. And that means all aspects of the business, not just getting the product to market and production and operations and R&D, but this CEO now is supposed to be raising capital and they need to have the expertise to do that.
I developed a model once for a company and I couldn't quite figure out the strategy very well, but once I built the model, it actually slightly changed the strategy of the company, because I think everybody just realized, oh, that is our strategy and that's how we're making money. They go hand in hand.
Financial models, when they're well done, and you can't separate these two, will, not may, will change the strategy. Yeah. And that's because CEOs and founders, when they're working with the business, produce or posit a strategy based on what they know. And you really don't fully understand what's going to happen to this business in the future until you build a really solid financial model. And then that financial model reveals things to you that you didn't know before. So you put a strategy out there, but you have this unknown, you don't know what you don't know black hole. And that financial model helps bring that to light and shines light on what you need to focus on, what you thought, Rob, probably wasn't right. It's going to be something different. And I show a graphic, which of course we can't show on the podcast here, but I normally show a graphic of a circle. And the financial model is at, let's say, the 3 o'clock position. That's the build of the financial model. And then you start running business cases as you come down to 6 o'clock. And then you get some outputs. And the outputs are revenue, how much capital is needed, return on investment, all the kinds of things that tell you about the business. And you look at the outputs and you realize, oh, that's not going to give the investors the ROI they need for the amount of money they're putting in. Or, wow, I need way more money than I thought I was going to need because I forgot about replacing the equipment over time because it's going to wear out. Those kinds of things become revealed. And then you have to come up to 12 o'clock after the learnings, change your assumptions. In other words, change your inputs to the model and rerun the model and now see the outputs. And when this is done well, we are typically running hundreds of business cases to understand how the business will work in the environment that we're seeking. And that's why when we have what we call as the base case, the case that we want to go after for this business, and investors ask the founder all the questions that the founder has already been through by running those hundreds of base cases before, that they can answer pretty much anything the investor wants to know. Well, how come you didn't consider doing this? And the founder's not flustered. The founder says, oh, we did. And here were the results from that. And that's why we didn't do that. And now the investor says, oh, they did their homework. They understand the product and the market and supply and demand and elasticity and competition. And it gives the investors such confidence in the founder. And that's what you want. You want to tell that emotional story to excite the investor. And then you want to give them the confidence that you are the right one as CEO and the right team to take this particular product or service forward.
Yeah. It also speaks to, you as the founder can't know everything, right? And so it speaks to the fact that, you know, for every problem, you need to find a who. Right? Who's going to help me? And you know, in my business, I find that's one of the toughest things to do is, you know, I've got a problem. Who can help me with this? And as I was saying earlier in the last season, we had, you know, somebody from Car to come on cap tables. We had somebody from, you know, I'm just throwing out names here, but Baker Tilly come on regarding audits. And we had, someone from VLP Law Group come on regarding legal structures and contracts and, you know, all these liabilities you might have that if you're not set up beforehand, I mean, you gotta, you know, it's going to cost you more to fix it than to set it up properly. And it also, I think early on as a founder, when you're at the seed stage, if you can find, and I know this is one of your terms, but if you can be a trusted counselor, if you can find, you know, a Brett who's gonna, you know, before you even need it, just say, hey, like, you don't have to pay me a lot, but let me just do a little mini audit here of the company, or let me spend 5 hours this month just giving you advice. And when you're ready, like, we can work more, or you can work with someone else, or you come to, you know, you have, you know, a senior legal person who's an advisor who you go to for questions, you know, two hours a month when you really don't need a lot of it, but you just need everything set up properly. You know, that is, you know, that's something that I look for. And as my company has grown and gotten bigger, I'm able to pay for that as well. But when you're at the seed stage, you might not be able to pay for it all. So just being able to reach out for a couple of hours can be invaluable.
So you just hit some really key points. And I want to do a sidestep here for a minute and go off on a side rail because it's huge. Getting back to the time again, you brought it up. I want to shine the spotlight on it. If you don't have the right trusted advisors, trusted counselors, you are going to waste time and money. So great that your last year or last period of podcast focused on some of those key pieces of audit and cap table and legal structure and all that. Those are huge. And many people go down the wrong road with legal structure, for example, and then they have to correct. Well, of course they can correct it, but now they've added 30 days or 45 days, plus it's cost them another $5,000 or $10,000. That's precious, both of those, time and money, at that point in your history of the business. Trusted counsel you brought up. One of my clients is in Italy, and I've been working with them for 5 years. And I came up with the consulente term for a reason. It means trusted counselor in Italian. And I do believe you need trusted counselors, as you were just saying, across the board. And then the question is, how do you find the best people to keep your time down and significantly increase your chances of being successful? And whether that's selling the product or service or raising capital or putting a strategy in place. One of the things I came up with about a year ago for this exact reason, when companies hire me, I'm usually working with them for a minimum of 3 months, because that's how long it takes to do many of the things we've just been talking about, pitch deck, financial model, coaching this founder through those types of things. But there are also companies out there who, number one, they're not ready for that. They don't have what they need. A lot of questions come up, but maybe they've got a pitch deck, or maybe they've got some ideas. So what I started offering was exactly what you just brought up: a small amount of my time, my 30 plus years of experience doing this, where the client can come in, I will have them present to me over Zoom, their pitch deck, their concept, their idea. I'll go away for a couple of days, and then I'll come back and give them an assessment of what I see. You're on the right track. You need to focus on these things. They come away with a work plan so that they know exactly what they need to do to be successful, either on the strategy or the capital raise side or both. And that roadmap then allows them to move the business forward without spending the huge amount of money that they would normally have to spend to really go out and raise that $5 million or $10 million. And it's one of the ways I give back to the community. You know, it's a nominal fee, but they come away with, oh, I've now got a plan and I can go execute that plan. And I can call James and I can call some of James's other people to help me get this done.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of value in the network as well. So if you know somebody who knows, you know, the best people, that there's a lot of value. So just switching gears to, you know, having you a little bit as kind of that advisor mind, where you go a little bit more specific, there are a few key questions that just come up over and over and over again. And one that I haven't mentioned to you, but that I'm actually facing with a couple of clients right now is, you know, they have great businesses. They haven't raised equity yet. They both have revenues, quite significant revenues, and they're getting ready to scale. Everything's coming in getting into place, and they'd like a little bit of capital. So they're thinking of, hey, let's do a small debt raise before the equity raise, and once the equity raise is happening, we can pay down some of the debt, or we just raise some more debt in conjunction with the equity. What has been your experience with raising debt first, just to get the valuation up, get the company a little bit further along, so you're not having to give away that much equity?
So that key phrase was the last two or three words you just said: not having to give away too much equity. And it's well worth spending a bit of time on that before we get back to the debt question, because that phrase, which of course is summarized in the word dilution for anybody who's raising money, is a big one. And I work with founders all the time who have been burned in the past in a startup because they lost control of the company. And I'll get into why in a bit. But they're not concerned about that. They're concerned that they lost control and their dream went up in smoke. They don't have anything to show dollar-wise for what they did. So dilution becomes a big driver. And dilution in many cases is very emotional. People really get angry, get scared about, I don't want to be diluted. I don't want to lose control and lose my business. And I think intellectually, it's a great question to ask. How do I retain enough control? Because I think I'm the best person to run the business. So then the comment that you just made, great, I'll raise some debt to keep my equity raised down and keep dilution down. Now, anytime there's debt on the books, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it raises a yellow flag to equity investors. Because when there's debt on the books, and I'm not talking about convertible debt that's going to convert to equity when the preferred round at a specific level or greater is raised. That's what convertible debt does, as you know. It converts from debt to equity on the books. That's fine. No issue with convertible debt at all. And it's one of the best vehicles you can use to raise an initial seed round for a variety of reasons. But we could have a whole discussion on that. If you're looking at raising a small amount of debt, the question I would ask is why? Because it's going to raise a yellow flag in the equity investors' minds, because those debt holders are going to get repaid before the equity holders put money in. And let's just say you have $100,000 in debt on the books. I'm using it because it's a nice round number. If you then go out and raise $1 million in equity, $100,000 of that million may go to pay off the debt holders. So now the equity holders have invested $900,000. So 10% is going to pay debt. But if you're only raising $500,000 and $100,000 is going to pay debt, you've doubled the amount percentage-wise that's going off to pay debt. And the equity investors want to see their money being used for one thing: building the company, R&D, go to market, whatever your key focus is for that money raise, and putting it towards that. So if somebody came to me, which happens all the time, and said, I want to go out and raise some debt to move me along, to get my valuation up so I don't have to have as much dilution, I would say, first, let's get the financial model either built or vetted to make sure we know that this amount of money is right, and that you're not missing something, and so that we know what the next round looks like. And then I want to help the client figure out how they can get to the place they need without raising regular debt. Convertible debt, a bridge round, which is a small round from the equity investors to get you to another point. And then if you meet some milestones, they will give you a different valuation. There's a variety of ways to deal with that. Friends and family money coming in as convertible debt. But I like to avoid debt in the early stages. Now, you also then made a comment, what about if we raise some equity and then raise some debt on top of that? That's fine. If you have some debt on the books, and let's just say now you raise $2 million in equity and you want to bring in another $500,000 in debt, the next round equity holders, as long as you're reaching your milestones and doing what you said you were going to do, will be fine with that.
Okay. But if you did raise debt, if you did raise debt before equity, you might be okay if you were actually throwing off cash and making a profit already, which is not typical for a, you know, seed stage VC.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes. In the later stages, and you've got revenue and you can pay off the interest and maybe even some principal on that, or the balloon that's going to come due, equity investors might be fine with that. But that's typically not the case, as you just said, right on, for a small company that is pre-revenue, mm-hmm. or small revenue with negative EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And there is no money to put towards debt. So the only place that money can come from is the equity holders when they put that money in. Exactly right.
Okay. Going back to the dilution and losing control. You know, I think one of the biggest concerns as, you know, if you're an angel investor, is you put money in and, you know, even if there's, you know, it's pro rata, like, and it's hugely successful, you know, you're an angel investor, you're not a, you know, someone who can keep putting huge amounts of money in through Series D and IPO. So, yep. So as an investor, you get diluted. As the founder, you keep getting diluted as well. What are some of the things to look out for? You know, probably at the earlier stages, you know, at the later stages, you'll get, you know, more advice from different people. But at the earlier stages, how do you not just, you know, screw up and, you know, and say, man, I've worked so hard and I made a terrible decision?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant question, actually, because it's one of the ways that founders really get in trouble quickly, because they make the decision without full knowledge. The first piece is that if you're at a seed round or an A, you really don't typically have loss of control dilution issues as being a key piece, because in a typical Series A round, a venture investor is going to take someplace between 20 and 35% of the company. And obviously, as a founder, you want them to be lower in the percentage wise than higher in general, but that may not hold you in good stead for the follow-on round. And the reason is because if you convince them to take a lower percentage ownership at A, and you fail to meet the milestones that you talked about for B, you now have to far outweigh with some milestones that you have to get that next round. So getting the lowest dilution in A is not the best case either. You want to get what I call is the right amount of dilution for A. And what does that mean? And back to your question, because it's really important here. One of the ways, and probably the biggest way, that founders lose control or get too diluted is by promising things that they don't have a 100% chance, let's just say 80% chance of delivering. And I cannot tell you, this is a huge problem. Founder gets really excited. They're going to promise that they're going to be doing these things in, pick the time, 18 months. We're going to have $10,000 a month in revenue. We're going to have 4,000 recurring revenue customers. Our churn's only going to be 0.5% annually. Fill in the blanks. And the investor takes that information and writes it down and records it when you say that. Just because you threw it out at a pitch meeting, it's not on a piece of paper, it's recorded. And that might be part of the term sheet. If you get to that point in that 12 to 18 to 24 month timeframe where you fail to meet all your milestones, or you fail to meet some of the critical ones, that's when you have loss of control and dilution problems. Because basically what you've done is you've told the investor, this is my path to success, right? We're going to go from point A, and in 18 months, the valuation is going to double. Let's just say we're looking for a 2X step up in valuation. In order to get that 2X step up, we're going to meet these milestones. Here's 6 milestones. And then you're going to show them your exit at the end of the model, and it's going to show them with a 12X return on their investment in 3 years. I'm just throwing numbers out, but ballpark. Well, if you don't meet the milestones in that 18-month timeframe, the investors know you can't meet the 12X return in 3 years. So now that 2X step up in valuation is non-existent. And that means that the next investors that are going to come in at Series B, of course, they're going to look back at what the milestones you posited at A. They're going to see that you didn't meet them. And they are going to either be much less likely to invest, or they're going to want a much greater percentage ownership in the business to invest. And that's going to cause the A round investors to get more diluted. Yes, they've got pro rata rights, but they're going to have to put in money to get that. So it really puts you in a very desperate situation, because now you haven't met what you said you were going to meet. And now you have the potential of losing control of the business. Now, let's be careful here. We just talked about this all from a financial perspective. And one of the things that founders frequently do is they only focus on the financials. percentage ownership, dilution, and all of that. But there are governance issues on the other side as part of your deal with a, with an investor that talk about board control, board seats, what you're allowed to do and not do. And those, in many cases, will frequently trump the ownership percentage issues. So if you don't do what you said you were going to do, the board could step in and take you out as CEO potentially, because that's written into the government clauses, governance clauses, having nothing to do with money, but you're not running the business anymore. So founders frequently only pay attention to the financial side, lose the governance side, and then end up in a place they don't want to be. So James, again, this is where the initial advisors that you have, the VLP law group that you mentioned from a prior podcast, those types of advisors are critical to you in your earliest stages. They will help set you up well for the future.
Yeah.
You don't have that, you can easily get into trouble. There are hundreds of variables out there. I call them mines in the minefield. And a good consulente is going to help you avoid the mines in the minefield.
Yeah. It also points to the map, right? The map of, you know, the ladder of, you know, C to A to B to C to D, you know, what is needed at each stage, you know, what revenues can we get to? What's the trajectory? Because a lot of times, you know, you have no idea and it's just like, hey, my model has, you know, it's a hockey stick. I did it. I figured out the formulas. But there's so much more to it. And that's what you're talking to.
That's exactly right. I mean, when I typically start working with a client, I will ask them early, probably before we even start working, how much money do you need now? And of course, need is relative. And how much money do you need in the follow-on two rounds? And I frequently get a blank stare. They think they know how much money that they need now, and they show me. It may or may not be grounded. Usually it's not with a good financial model. But then they have no idea how much they need in the next two rounds. And when I work with a client, I won't let them go out for the current round until we know how much we need for the follow-on two, because that's what the investors need to know. They need to understand, what does this business case look like? Your example of the map, right? How are you going from now to exit? Yeah. And as a founder CEO, you need to understand that to present it well.
Yeah. And you're just pointing to a follow-on conversation that we've already discussed that we'll have, which is, what do you need to know about the VC? Right. And so the VC has a fund and is going to invest in a Series A and is going to keep money back to invest further down the line. And how much money do they need to keep back? And they need to know that to be successful for their investors.
Yeah. We haven't even touched most of the investor side requirements, right? We talked a little bit about that earlier, where you were talking about, and I think you put out there some numbers for what kind of return they're looking for and those kind of things. Certainly, you need to understand those as founder, because they're your lifeblood. But there are dozens of other things that the investors need and want, and you can't really present to them well unless you know what those are and how you're going to meet them. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Just one last question around putting together the whole round, the whole fundraise. So I think it's you know, sometimes you don't need a lot and you go to a family office and they'll give you the whole amount, which is great and a lot easier. But most of the time it's, you know, there's multiple investors. And so there'll be the anchor, the lead, and some others. What do we need to keep in mind when we look at, you know, who the lead is, how big they are, how hard should we negotiate the term sheet? Who should be our advisor on the term sheet? You know, and who should be the smaller ones, and what role do they play going to a B round and a C round?
So the question you just asked, and I think you know this, we could spend an hour on without even scratching the surface, but let me see what I can do in a short amount of time. Part of looking for the right investor is you're really looking for the lead. And the lead, for those in the audience listening that don't know, is the investor that is typically putting in the largest amount of the round. But most importantly, to the point you just made, is the one that's setting the terms for the round. They are the ones that are going to issue the term sheet. How much of the ownership percentage are the investors going to get for the amount of money? In other words, what do they get from you for the money given? What are the liquidation preferences? How is the rest of the term sheet structured in terms of some of the governance points we just talked about? So they are the ones negotiating this. And you are going to be negotiating with the lead on the term sheet. They're the ones that issue the term sheet. There are two different types of investors, leads and follows. The follows are the ones that follow the term sheet that the lead gave you. So whatever was negotiated, the follows are in or out based on who the lead is and what term sheet situation is in terms of negotiation. The lead is the one that typically brings along the follow investors. They've worked with them before on other deals. They have expertise in the space, so they want to present the deal to them. Sometimes, if you've spoken to a VC and didn't know early enough, you're talking to a follow. And they will tell you that, wow, we're really interested, but you need to find a lead, right? We hear that all the time. And ideally, you don't want to ever hear that because you made your selection to only talk to leads. But if you do have a follow, you can say, great, can you tell me who would be good for me to talk with who might lead this round? Huge question. It could have huge ramifications, and founders frequently don't ask it of the follow. Not just leave the room, okay, great, I'm going to go find it. Who do you recommend? And in theory, they should be able to give you a couple. The lead that you find then may or may not want to use the follows that you bring along. So that's part of the mix here in terms of determining, oh, this follow can come along in this round or not. But it is a big question in terms of what do you look at for the venture capitalists and who do you look at? And this is where some of the databases that are out in the environment, PitchBook is the biggest by far, you can use to screen VCs for this kind of information. When do they usually invest? Not what they say on the website. Oh, we invest in A rounds. And when you actually look at the PitchBook data, which is the data where they invested and how much and all that, you can see they haven't invested in an A in 3 years. They've been investing in later rounds. So that happens all the time. But part of this issue is, are they a lead or a follow? Are they the right series for you? All those kinds of questions. So important. And again, it's more of those minds in the minefield that are going to waste your time. And I'm going to say this now, and I'm going to repeat it next time we talk, but it's a key thing to potentially leave us with. Companies rarely run out of money. They run out of time. And of course, the money is a consequence of running out of time, but time is the big thing you have to manage. How quickly can you get this done? How can you mitigate wasting time and not putting your effort into anything that's not moving you toward your end goal, which is potentially fundraising and getting this business scaled?
Yep. Well, thanks, Brett. This was great. We'll pick it up again in part two, because I made a few more notes with questions because we can just keep going. But just to close, how can people reach you? What offerings do you have from, you know, in-depth consulting versus just, you know, advisory, where people can talk to you for a couple of hours a month?
So they can reach me on my website, which is broadscope.com, BROADSCOPE. There's a number of videos and articles on the site that talk about capital raise, because that's a big piece of what I do. I highly recommend you get into them and read them. They're short. You should be able to get through them in 5 minutes. But there are articles on the business plan, on the financial model, on fitting it all together, on really giving you a grounded sense of what you need to do as a founder to move the business along. So that's one piece. The second piece is I offer, as I said earlier, that short evaluation, analysis, assessment, and work plan to companies. And they can get in for a nominal amount of money. They can send me a note and say, hey, I want to do that. Can you tell me how much it costs and what this looks like? And you're typically around $5,000 for something like that. If you can't afford the $5,000, you're probably not at the right stage to be looking at raising money, right? You need to at least have that base there. And I will give them that evaluation and the work plan so that they can go out and establish. For those companies that want to use me as that consulente role, I'm happy to do that and happy to talk about what that looks like, depending upon what's needed and how much access they need to my expertise and time. And you know, those range anywhere from that 5,000 and up. But all that can be garnered just by looking at the website. You can set up a Zoom with me. There's a Book Me link on the website, and you can set up a 30-minute Zoom for no charge. And we can have that initial conversation, get a sense of where you are, what you're looking for, and what my recommendations are in counsel to potentially get what you want as that startup founder or CEO.
Perfect. Well, Brett, thank you so much. And we'll be talking again soon.
Thanks, James. I'm looking forward to part two. See you soon.
This episode of the Scale by Numbers podcast is brought to you by our new virtual advisory subscription called CFO Thinking Partner. It's a monthly membership that offers CFO level support and expert guidance that will fast track your business goals, financial skills, and fundraising efforts. You will have access to live support, resources, and tools to move you past any obstacle that is stalling your company's growth efforts. For more information, go to products.vanrusselventures.com/CFO Thinking Partner. Again, that's products.vanrusselventures.com/CFO Thinking Partner.